Session number 26590, General Wilhelm Moore, Reel 15. Still noisy.
I think after commanding at Gardermoen, you went to the staff again.
I went to Gardermoen. I went to Rig while we established that one. Building, construction and all that. And I was number two then on the area commander for the Eastern District. And then I was taken into staff. And I was, chief of staff, and a DCOS.
What was the purpose of building at Riga? What was going to be happening there?
Well, it was a fighter base. And it was really to get more down in the towards Denmark, towards Central Europe, and towards the Baltic area. And Gardermoen was a little remote. It was a little further. You can say that Lister too was also oriented in a way towards what happened in Europe. More than what happened in our country.
How far could you have gone from those places? Could you have gone across, well, East Germany into Poland, for example?
You could reach down in all that area, yes. And, yes, you could. It was a new base, and of course civil aviation hadn't really stepped into, so it wasn't sort of being pushed there. It was really an infrastructure idea, a little more base in Norway than we had before. And of course we made many of those. And so I was in the building period of that one, and I was also number two in the command.
Did you have anything to say about the design of the airfield, the way it was laid out?
But there was sort of a common system on that one, that you could do the layout, direction, and so on. Oh yes, and of course you had to do a fair amount to do with the labouring,
yes,
part of it, and all that, contracting people and so on. And so we established ourselves down there, the way you wanted the base layout and so on. Of course I'd been in that before, so but it was an interesting period, yes.
Did you find it easy to manage the contractors and deal with them?
Oh yes. No problem. Yes, it was a good base, nice place of Norway to be in. And the only trouble was that it was sort of 30 degrees off the main wing. So it was all right for fighters, but it wasn't so good for slower airplanes like the Dakota and so on. They had a certain time, they had a little problem. But
so
that's not more than we could take. Of course, they talk now about establishing some civil activity down at Riga, and it may well come. Let me see. Now, we had the length of the runway and the what we call the LCT, the weight it could carry, the width of it, and the system of lightning, the distances to the parallel taxiway, and all that was set up as a NATO standard. That was used there. And when we extended existing airfields like Stavanger, Forus, down that way, Sula, and so on, and then it was the same thing, Ørland, and Værnes and so on, they built to the same standard. Long runways, actually.
Were they built to accommodate Allied aircraft as well?
Oh yes.
Was there a plan for reinforcing Gardermoen and
Oh yes. And Gardermoen, of course, had included the recovery thing of bombers if they needed to take them in and so on. But otherwise, of course, we had an ongoing problem, really, was one of the was the business of foreign bases on Norwegian soil, and also that includes then what activity could have of foreign allied activity in from our bases, and also you had this problem with the nuclear weapon in Norway. It was a big issue really at the time, and that affected me quite a bit, I must say, because at the one hand you should say that they landed on a sort of an idea that you couldn't have any foreign troops in, or you couldn't have any nuclear weapons in, lest you feel threatened or were attacked. That, of course, left it then somewhat up to us, and it was quite a smart way of doing it, because it meant that it wouldn't be used unless you were attacked or felt threatened, and then, of course, there was no question of using it. I remember our ambassador in Moscow at that time, he visited me once, and he thought it was quite a smart solution, he said, because the public opinion was very much against it. But then he said, maneuvering that, it's really the other part who plays the card. You just react to what they are doing, and then, of course, it's a very different position. So he thought it was, he said that even the Russians must have problem with that. He said, remind them that they are such good poker players. He thought that we had really got the upper hand on them. In that. But my problem was really that if you say that you might sort of suddenly have nuclear weapons and supposed to be able to use them yourself, it needs training. And then if you want to do training, you just got to train. And how do you do it? I mean,
you have to have the weapons there.
Well, you can have fake weapons or anything, but you know, you can't hide these from a hungry press, you know. And I remember once I had a telephone call from the American commander, Yusefi, as it's called. He was number two to Sir Kerr. And he called me from down Germany, as he was, and said that he wanted to have a training laid on where they would fly in sort of a little set of people, fairly few, and nuclear weapons from America, and land at Flesland and prepare themselves for using this as part of the Norwegian deal and so on. And I said to him that, don't do that. And he said, well, why shouldn't we do it? It's just duds, he said. And I said, it doesn't look that on a photograph. And you'll get an awful lot of after and so on if that happens. But he backed out of it. And I remember the Ministry of Defense amazingly called me fairly few hours afterwards and said, thank you very much for seeing that. And I always wondered, how did he get to know? How did he get to know that I had had that conversation with him? But it was a touchy thing, and I must say that we did train, yes. And we couldn't hide that. People could see that we were doing, and some people would always tell somebody what we were actually, and so on. It was an ongoing problem, really, just that. But I just refused. I said, I don't want. You've got to behave so that it's deemed realistic from the Russian point of view. If they see that you have this slogan that you should use it when it's threatened, and they see that you don't train, it's just a bluff, and you stand much weaker than you would otherwise. I was strong on that one. We did train and got criticism for it and all those things, you know.
An essential part of deterrence. And what sort of targets were you thinking of?
Well, this was a sort of tip-off thing, and we just trained on a place up north. A little sort of island, small thing, just to have a target. Mm. But of course, the idea was that we're in an attack, a launched attack with bombers or whatever, we should go in ahead, and we should, get that airfield, so that sort of thing. And this tip-off from a fighter plane isn't all that accurate anyway.
No.
So
it's definitely
an aerial. It, yeah, it really is. But you've got to show that you train, and show it to the right people that you train, you know. And then try it as hide as you, try to hide it as best you can to newspapers and the public. Well, I had trouble on that.
Did you think of making attacks on follow-on forces on the second echelon of any Soviet movement? Was that an idea to use such weapons against Soviet ground forces if they were?
To be quite honest, I suppose that our training could never be that much that you would say that you were capable, thinking the restricted number of these weapons that exist.
Yes.
If I was an American or anybody who controls that sort of thing, I wouldn't give it to amateurs.
Mm-hmm.
And we could be target support people. And that's where really, the 104 was very suitable for that. And I suppose about the only airplane you could survive in for that sort of job, and limited to that, make a disarray with radar things and that sort of thing to pave the way from the real stuff.
Yes,
that would be the limit of what we could do anyway.
So you would be the reconnaissance and the feint.
Hmm?
You would be the reconnaissance and the feint.
Yeah.
And the main attack
would come later. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Pave the way. That's just like we did during the war, taking shipping and that sort of thing. It's you know, just in and get the thing right, or at least help.
You were saying earlier that you're on the standing group, the American standing group, for 3 years. When were you doing that job?
57. I was at Riga at the time.
Yeah. And did that involve traveling to the United States?
Oh, we lived there.
You lived there?
3 years.
Yeah, 3 years. 57, 60.
Mm.
What was the standing group and what was it?
Well, standing group was the executive element of the military committee, which was, of course, the heads of all the defense organizations around. And so you were extremely central in the business or so on.
The whole of NATO, presumably.
Yeah, yeah. And being in the Pentagon, I worked in Pentagon, I had nothing to do really with the Norwegian sides as such, embassy and so on, except that I had a pleasant relationship with them, but I had nothing functionally with them.
So you were a NATO officer?
I was a NATO officer. And I was then secretary to General Uhlen, who was the chairman in that period. 1 year of the period, but the system was so you came early and you stood on a year afterwards. That was to augment the staff at the country's cost, of course. But it was really quite a good system. So I stayed there 3 years with my family. We had three very happy days, very hard working days, I would say. And I got in very. You know, what you do in a job like that is to prepare all meetings, keep the chairman informed about what the sort of general things on and what the status of papers and so on, and fuse in his ideas about things he wants on the agenda for the next things and fix it, write reports and that sort of thing. I remember there was a secretary on the logistics side, British, he was amusing and sharp fellow actually. He said to me that life there as a secretary is a pretty rough business. But you've got to watch out so you are not being sort of a crooked too, you know. Because he read me a song, I remember that one, I think. And so while the great ones depart for the dinner, the secretary stays getting thinner and thinner, wrecking his brain to record and report what he thinks they would think that they ought to have thought. And it's very true, you know. You can almost see the Turkish representative go out of the room and say, damn it, I ought to have said that, and so on. But when you know the game, you can phone him up and say to him that, well, this is what you said, but I don't think you like that in the report, you know, and so on. Could we say it this way, you know? And you were sort of having lick of your hair, and you know, of course you never did it free, you know, something other, that's what my friends meant, you know, you can be a little crooked in the way, you know.
You have to manipulate
it. Yeah, it becomes at the secondary, really, in your system.
Did you normally circulate draft minutes of meetings before you wrote the final version?
Yes. You had a system. You had a director in the staff too, and you showed him what you intended. But you were extremely dependent, really, also in preparing the meetings and doing things and so
what,
on.
What kind of issues were being discussed by the standing group?
Pardon?
What sort of issues came up for the standing group while you were there? Can you remember anything in particular that was important?
Well, they had one which they've been fighting in. I remember General Fuchs, the Canadian, once said that no issue has been paid more lip service to than this one, and that subject was balanced collective forces, because it's sort of on and on and on, you know, that couldn't we sort of say that the Americans do that, the British do that, we do that, they do that.
You specialize
and so on, but you know, every country want to have their own balance at the same time. So. But that was, of course, to save money and be more effective for what you meant. That was one. And then it was the strategic concept, which was, of course, an ongoing, always revising and so on as time goes on. And the infrastructure build-up, for example. And
were there any major changes to the strategic concept while you were there?
Yes, there was one that was really starting in my time, but certainly so on, and that was caused by de Gaulle getting to the position he had and his ambition to bring France forward and also to control the British influence this was his way, you know. And this caused stir, and what particularly stirred it was that he had one that was almost amusing. It was a good, very good atmosphere in this organization, I'll say that. Good people in the top, very good people at the top. But I remember that one of the first things he said that we should speak, all French should speak French, not English, you know, and so it came up. The question of how on earth can you do that? I mean, interpreters aren't all that easily available for, and cost do it too, and not clever all this, and so on. But then General Piat, who was a French top man there, and so on, he said, ah, oh, pas de problème. He said, we all speak English, so we are our own interpreters. He said, that's easy, that, don't worry. But there were many issues where you could sometimes sit back and amuse yourself also. A different sort of thing. I remember when you came up against one tricky thing, touchy thing, and so on. The Admiral Denny, he was as sharp as a needle, British, and so on. And he would sort of turn back to his staff officer and say, "What did we do last time on this?" You know, just to have it so on. The American, he would sort of say, "Oh, don't worry, we'll check the problems as they come. We'll just go ahead, you know. Let's get on with it, you know." And the French, General Piat, and so on, he would sit back and say, ah, mais c'est pas logique, you know, that's all he cared about, not the issue, but whether it was logic. Yeah. That's what he cared about. So you had these funny instances, but one very serious thing that came up in my time, again with de Gaulle, was that he wanted his own nuclear weapon, and he wasn't part of the two, and he just went on. And he got a nuclear weapon with a great sort of worry about how going to control it. And the fact was, of course, that he wanted to tie the American to Europe in the sense that if some Russians came across and threatened France, he could use it and then be sure Americans would be in that war. You know, it's as simple as that, a simple philosophy as that, to be sure. Otherwise, he could say that with the Russians getting nuclear weapons, as they did, getting the delivery capability with a nuclear weapon, which that you could see that they were getting. America might well, in his opinion, say that leave Europe, we just stand off.
Look after ourselves.
He wanted to make sure. And so he insisted. The only trouble was that at the time, he didn't have the delivery means for the nuclear. He got the nuclear weapons. After all, that technology isn't, you can't keep that. But he got also, he didn't have the nuclear weapon at the time. He had a fighter plane, more or less, but he couldn't reach even the eastern part of Germany, which in fact meant that if the Russians came threatening France, as was his beginning in his thoughts, when he would use the nuclear weapon would be inside Germany. And it is a gruesome scenario when you think of it in an alliance. And I would always say that when NATO can get themselves out of a dilemma of that nature, they can get themselves out of a lot of dilemmas, including the present one and so on, you know, because that was really a big thing. Yes. But eventually, of course, France got delivery means of longer range, and also we got moved into, by help of General Nordstad at the time, moved into the flexible response idea instead of the all-out
massive retaliation
idea. And the discussion about this problem sort of got a little more tempered by events.
While you were there, did the French ever discuss the possibility of coordinating their nuclear strategy with the British and American?
They wanted to be independent. They just didn't want to have, they wanted to be sure that they could have the trigger that would set the Americans in action. I think that's it. But you know, we had this bomb plane, but even we didn't get to see that one. Because that was an American-British...
We had the V-bombers in Britain, of course. Hmm? We had the V-bombers in Britain.
Yeah, yeah. But this business of the actual weapon sites and targets and priorities sort of things and so on, that wasn't a document that even was let out in the NATO broad. It would have leaked, you can be sure.
Yes. Yeah.
So I had a good understanding for that.
It was
an interesting thing, and I also remember the period when the Germans got into the NATO. That happened in my time. That also had a certain amount of hesitation.
Yes. You know,
on parts, including our own country, to what extent and so on.
Do you and remember there, discussions about what the German forces would be used for?
Exactly.
I mean, what was the idea about the uses of the Bundeswehr? How were they going to be employed?
Exactly. And also, it had one implication there, and that was that the Germans were admitted in, but their representation in headquarters should be proportional to their strength. Ships and soldiers and air and so on. And then to be able to get as much influence as they could, they built up strength. And their trouble with the 104, which you probably heard about a lot. Yeah, they had a lot of so on, came from the fact that they were building up the Air Force very fast, and they had a period with no action after the war. It was simply not there. So they had to build it from ground. They found probably some elder technicians and so on, but they weren't geared for a complicated airplane like that. If they had taken an easier airplane, it would have been different, but they were taking a complicated airplane, the Thunderjet. And they had ambition for usage of it, which also set high requirements on low-flying navigation and that sort of thing. So that is why it mounted the accidents. And they had a tremendous accident rate, as you know. So it was a hard time for them. But they were very ambitious. And this, it had to do with sort of getting so much influence at the headquarters. But it wasn't only the Air Force. I remember the Navy the Americans were very hesitant on the amount of influence that they could get in Norfolk by mere fact that they had so and so ships. And then they said, now what are the ships worth? You want to see things in relation. So there was problems in that field too.
The army, because the Bundeswehr built up very rapidly, didn't
they? They all did.
Of course. Yeah.
I can't give a characteristic there, I just don't know, but I know the Air Force. And of course it ended up in the Air Force by the fact that they just had to cut down on flying hours, because they couldn't produce the amount of flying hours available. And when they did that, it went to the training of pilots, and then they weren't qualified enough, and then you get accident on that account.
Yes.
And the only remedy, which they did late, was really to cut down on the flying activity altogether. Fewer airplanes in the air, more maintenance on fewer airplanes and qualified but then, of course, and build it gradually up rather than taking it all in and get stomach trouble on the way. So it was the only solution. They did it. But it was a tough time for them. And incidentally, when we got the 104, it was very much sort of pointed to the losses in Germany and saying, can you live with 50 accidents per 100,000 flying hours? He says, can you live with that? And we went for a whole year, we didn't do one single accident. It shows what it means to come unprepared to a complicated instrument. You know.
Would you say...
We had about 14 or something like that.
Yes. Would you say that the most important element in an Air Force is the training of the pilots? Is that the right way?
Yeah, it's a ground crew as well. It's got to go parallel.
You're mentioning the French made themselves unpopular about the business of their own deterrent, but in NATO organisations there are not only issues about defence, there are also more political issues as well.
Oh, yes.
How did you find dealing with the Turks and the Greeks? Was there trouble there?
Well, every so often, of course, we went to Paris and had the meeting in the council, and then all the ministry and foreign ministers met. It was a higher level, then the military committee, which then General Owens chaired under those circumstances, while he had his year. And so they were an instrument for the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and they decided political issues of how the alliance should move. But I must say that I found that relationship good working mechanism, really good working mechanism, because all countries had to prepare those things. I mean, the Chief of Defense, when they met at the Military Committee in Washington, and so on, they knew pretty well what the country would tolerate and not tolerate and so on. And I suppose that as time went on, nuclear weapons weren't just a bigger bang, but people understood that it had more impact on the human substance of things than military people are apt to have. In the first case, it became more and more a political issue about how do you handle it. And then this developed the question of sort of whose finger on the trigger. Is it only one country, or is it the one who has the weapons, or is it the people on the soil on which it stands and all that. And we tackled it, as I say, in the way that we didn't want nuclear weapons in peacetime, except on the science zone. In that case, we accepted, of course, that professional people would come in and help along, although we were supposed to fly. I've gone through that. But other countries had different formulas on that. The Germans had a typical two-finger trigger idea about it.
So did they want the right to veto the use of nuclear weapons?
Hmm?
Did the Germans want the right to veto?
Yeah, that sort of thing. It's an ongoing thing, and I met this problem when I had it after I had been chief of, you know, of the Air Force for 5 years. I went to consult as deputy, as I mentioned to you. I got middle into that sort of problem then, because this business of release of weapon is a tricky thing, and it isn't as easy as people will. Well, it's tricky politically, but it's also it is technically also quite a complicated thing. Take, for example, that you have been North Norway.